Thanks, Jermaine. I want to start off with a bit of history. The issue of health equity has been studied for more than 100 years. And in 1896 to 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois, when he was at Atlanta University, did a fair amount of work on disparities. It's a concept that has been around as long as there's been African-American scholarship. So Du Bois started off with, in the Atlanta, the set of Atlanta surveys, looking at health equity from a disparities point of view, but also looked at economic issues and housing and all sorts of other issues. And the Atlanta University program ended around 1910. So we can fast forward and look at 1989 to 1993, and Lew Sullivan, when he was Secretary of Health, started the Office of Minority Programs at the NIH. There were offices of minority health at the, in the Secretary's office, but there was no research agenda for equity work. And if you talk to Dr. Sullivan, he'll explain to you that he thought that equity research was critical in the development of programs that could reduce the gap that was first described in the Heckler report, an earlier Secretary of Health report. And I think Dr. Sullivan is critical in the understanding of the growth of equity research in since the 90s through to now. I mean, everybody does equity work, and equity is almost as if you don't say the words equity or disparities, you're not really serious about the work that you're doing. Whether you're serious when you say the words equity and disparities, I'm not sure, but much of the work and funding that comes out of NIMHD is the result of the earlier Office of Minority Programs, and John Ruffin was identified as the first director of that office, and John retired when the Office of Minority Health became the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities in 2010. So it's a long, long story. This 1906 publication marks the beginning of the second cycle of study that takes up again the subject of the physical conditions of the Negro, but enlarges the inquiry beyond the mere matter of mortality. In fact, earlier Atlanta University publications really focus only on mortality. And so, if you look at the 1906 study, it was based on 9 different components of routinely collected surveillance data at that time. And they include the census, life insurance company data, vital records from various cities, etc. And Du Bois organized these data into a series of tables in the 1906 report. And he has a table from that report, death rates at certain ages per 1,000 population. This is from that report that he edited. But if you look at it differently, you can see the death rates for the lines in green and red and brown are for blacks, and I use the terms that Du Bois uses in his publication to be historically correct, and the blue and purple line are whites of the time per 1,000 population in the U.S. for registered states, which were about at the time 20 or so states that were registration states. And you can see the gap between whites and blacks. It's actually quite an obvious gap. But you can look at the gap as a relative mortality rates gap, and you can see that black mortality is almost 250 times more prevalent from the ages of 1 through to about 15, 5 to 14 years, and then drops quite precipitously for the largest age group. So black and white mortality are almost equivalent for older people. This was data from Du Bois' table 2 in that publication. So, why are there equity issues for boys and men of color? There's contextual social determinants that define the place where African American men live, worship, play, and work. They've been removed from their families and their communities as the result of enslavement, post-Reconstruction racism and violence, Jim Crow segregation, and late 20th century structural racism that was exacerbated by wars on drugs and crime. These are fundamental causes of the gap between white folk and black folk, and in fact more dominant for white men and for men and boys of color. And it's actually quite interesting that This idea of wars on drugs and crimes arose out of the Moynihan Report of the 1965 that attempted to look at the black family as a family in crisis and attempted to underscore the reasons and approaches to improve that, improve the health of these families. But out of that work of Moynihan came an enormous amount of focus and attention on the disruptive behaviors, quote-unquote, of African-American men in their families. And if you actually read the work from Moynihan in 65 to the current work on black men in families, the narrative is a disruptive narrative, that black men are disruptive. And that narrative is still with us today. It's a very strong narrative, and people, if people argue that that narrative doesn't exist, all you have to think about are the deaths of young men at the hands of police. But those are just the sort of iceberg tip of the problem of the black man as a problem. The black man as a problem is a long history. I mean, you go back to the late 1800s, you find stories of black men as problems, and you come to 2015 and black men are still considered as problems. So African-American men are more likely to be poorly educated, unmarried, unemployed, in so low social status jobs, and have no wealth. If you actually measure the wealth of black men, it is much, much lower than any other race, gender group. They have high rates of adverse health behaviors, such as drug and alcohol abuse, poor diets, inadequate nutrition, lack of exercise, and early sexual experimentation, and issues with family formation dynamics, which I won't go into in this presentation. They have less access to health insurance. All these bits and pieces of information, the other speakers on this panel will speak a little bit more about, I hope. The philosophy economist Amartya Sen considers health to be a Rawlsian natural good. And it's based upon the books On the Theory of Justice by John Rawls and Sen's subsequent work on justice as the foundation stone of thinking about health. That health is about justice. And if you think of health as a Rawlsian good, it is influenced by relatively unobservable things like the degree of physical effort and biological endowment, and relatively observable things like access to basic Rawlsian freedoms like health, and material resources that ought to actually influence access to health. Bomnia and Stekov actually argue that if there's any relationship between material resources and access to health, that is in fact proof of health inequity. That if you have a relationship between the amount of money in your pocket and your access to a healthcare system, then you are in fact in a health inequity state. And as equity is increasingly realized, the direct relationship between material resources and health should diminish. So this model of the Rawlsian good model comes from Amartya Sen's work in this area, and is sort of reflected in the work of Angus Deaton, who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics, when he talks about wealth, health, and well-being. So I thought I should just put this up to give us a sort of starting point. So I want to go back and look at United States life expectancy in years by race and sex starting in 1900 and ending in 2013, the most recent data. These data come from the health registration states in 1900, from 22 to 33 in 1933, and then the full United States. And some of the variability that you see at the bottom end of this graph is a reflection of the poor quality of data. And you'll see this in other slides that I show that take us back to the early 1900s. So the problem is, if you look at this slide, it's very difficult to understand the gap and how the gap has changed over time between whites and blacks. So a different, and if I smooth out the curve, these are United States life expectancy data from 1900 to 2011 for men, and the red line represents African-American men. The blue line represents white, and the black are all men. And you can see that it appears that these two curves are coming together. If one just looks at this, the gap seems to be closing. So a more formal way of looking at this gap is to look at the relative difference which is the life expectancy of whites minus the life expectancy of African Americans divided by the life expectancy of whites as the reference group. And you can see the gap actually diminishes until about 1955, when the relative difference for males becomes stationary, and then in 1995 it drops again. And so this is the pattern of health disparities and the measure of health equity. And now, to separate those two ideas, disparities are measures of difference, and equity is how far we have to go to close the gap. So we can take another piece of data, United States infant mortality rates 1915 to 2011, and I've smoothed out the data so I don't show you the individual points. And these are for black females, black males, the blue line on top, black females, the red line, the purple line, white males, and the green line, white females. And they have the lowest infant mortality compared to blacks. And so it seems as if this gap is getting bigger as compared to the life expectancy gap. And that's to be expected because much of life expectancy improvements in the first half of the 20th century are the result of the improvement in child mortality data. So in fact, when you look at life expectancy in the second half of the 20th century, it's more an improvement in older people's well-being. In the first half of the 20th century, it's more an improvement in child mortality data. And just to show you that these trends seem to be similar for blacks and whites, I've shown you the annualized change in U.S. infant mortality rates as a percent. So the rate in 1 year subtracted from the rate in another year, and you create a percent by using the denominator in the earlier or later year, and you show the decrease in mortality as a percent of an earlier percentage, as a percent of an earlier rate. And you can see the black and the white rates for males are actually quite similar. The pattern seems to be similar, although there's a little bit more variability for African American data, because those data don't become very good until the late 20th century. Whereas for whites, the data tends to cluster more closely together as you move forward. And the second thing you should observe is that most of the mortality across the entire 20th century shows a remarkable 2.5% improvement in mortality by year, which is huge. I mean, that 2.5% decrease in mortality is a huge factor and occurs for both blacks and whites. But blacks have a worse starting point than whites. So, looking at the gap again, where this is the relative rate difference in infant mortality, you can see that by 2010, black infant mortality for black males is almost 142% higher than for whites. In fact, the gap between infant mortality has increased almost steadily over the 20th century, with some dips and rises. But at the end of the 20th century, we actually have a worse gap in infant mortality between blacks and whites than we had at the beginning of the 20th century. And that should give us pause, because we can talk all day about health equity, but if we don't understand the science of the problem, we're not going to be able to solve the problem. And what I've attempted to do here is look at infant mortality across a 100-year span, because I don't think it actually makes sense to look at infant mortality over two decades. I don't think you actually understand where the problem starts and where you ought to go. So the last few slides I want to look at are age-specific male mortality rates, and what you see here is a classic swoosh of mortality. It starts high, goes low, rises and has a bump, and then goes up. It's almost like the Nike swoosh. But it's a classic pattern. You see this in all populations around the world. The height of the curves are just different. And what I've shown here is the lowest curve is for 2010, which is the lowest mortality. I have 2005, which is the red, and 2000 is the red, and 2005 is the green. In fact, there's an overlap where the mortality becomes worse in 2005 for some age groups for men. So that's the classic mortality curve. However, if you look at the gap, the relative race-specific rate ratios for male mortality, an interesting thing happens. These are lines for every single year from 1990 to 2013, looking at the gap. And the topmost line is actually for the year 1999, and the bottom line is for the year 2013. So what you see is at the age of 16, there's a rapid increase in the gap in mortality for African-American men compared to white men. And that gap increases until you get to about 65 years, when there's a sudden drop in the gap in mortality. And most of the problem of the gap in mortality between whites and blacks sits in the range of young men. They have an increased mortality. It's something we don't notice because most people die either as children or as old people. But the gap actually exists mostly for the young people. And this is another way of looking at it. We have clustered the data in two age groups to have a better sense of how this thing rises and falls. As you can see, at infancy, the gap is actually at about 125%. And in the years that I'm talking about, the gap is about 70 to 90%. So, in fact, it's an interesting analysis of mortality data. So we know that this happens, and it's actually quite an important pattern within mortality data. So I want to finish off by just looking quickly at income inequality and health inequality, or health disparities, or health equity. And this is a Gini coefficient for income inequality in the United States from 1915 to 2010. And this work is fairly nicely illustrated in Thomas Piketty's book, Wealth in the 21st Century, and Angus Deaton's book, The Great Escape, and I suspect also well illustrated in Michael Marmot's new book on the gap. What you see is that the gap, that wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few people in 1915, 1916, and then it gets better distributed, and then it rises rapidly. So we have become a society of great disparities by the early 21st century. So does this have anything to do with health equity? Is wealth disparity a driver of health equity in populations? And I want to finish with this slide, which is U.S. income inequality on the vertical axis. With the higher the number, the better the inequality, and the lower the number, the worse the inequality. And what you can see is that infant mortality drops as inequality improves. Okay? I'll let you look at that for a bit to sort of get your eye around two different types of graphical tools. One is a simple line, a nonlinear regression with the actual points, and these are levels at the state level. And it shows fairly clearly that there is a relationship between wealth and health at the level of states. And if you look at the level of countries, you find the same thing. This graph was sort of influenced by the work of Samuel Preston and the Preston curve. This is a version of the Preston curve where I use infant mortality. And if I use life expectancy, it looks more like the Preston curve, that income and income inequality specifically drives the differences in infant mortality in the United States at the states level. So to conclude, before Jermaine kicks me off the stage, I'd like to argue that the problem of health equity is a 100-year-old problem in the literature, or maybe even longer than that. And we will do ourselves a good service if we do two things. One is to really clarify how big the gaps are and how the gaps have changed over time. And second, if we move away from the description of health inequities towards figuring out how to deal with interventions at the primary level, at the public health level, and at the hospital-based level. Because we do an awful lot of descriptions of equity issues and inequities, but we do very little for interventions. We as a public health organization ought to figure out how to close the gap. And if it's about wealth and wealth inequality, we may have a difficult problem. But Sen has argued that there is a way to offset the problems of income inequality whilst dealing with the problems of health inequality. And I would leave you with that thought, that I do this stuff just because I'm an epidemiologist, and epidemiologists never die. Their sample sizes just get smaller. But I'm more interested in interventions that make sense. Thank you.